The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a global challenge. This is humankind versus virus. And this isn't one country versus another. And the global cooperation is critical for so many of these issues, to stand up clinical trials, to work with regulators in other countries, to identify strategies that work and strategies that don't work. I mean, this should be a period of the world coming together, not coming apart. We should be helping other places. We should be getting help where we can from other places.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 14th, 2020. Josh Sharfstein is the Vice Dean of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He also served as the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. He was the principal deputy commissioner and at some point the acting commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and he was the commissioner of health for the city of Baltimore. He is remarkably well qualified to talk about coronavirus crisis response at the federal, state, and local levels. He's even written a book about managing public health crises, and he's hosting a podcast of his own daily on the coronavirus crisis. He joined me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about the role of coercion in managing these crises, how the U.S. government has performed and not performed, and what we should be doing differently to get the corona crisis under control. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 521, Josh Sharfstein on coronavirus. Josh, I'd like to start with just a accounting of your activities professionally that are relevant to this crisis. You're currently the vice dean of a school of public health. You ran the Food Drug Administration in a what may be the most relevant thing. You were a state health commissioner at one point, and you've done sort of healthcare policy work on the Hill. In addition to that, you were once upon a time my high school lab partner in chemistry, which I think may be the most important thing. So I guess I'm interested for you to start with sort of which aspects of your prior career are, or your current career, are giving you the most sort of input as you think about the current situation?
Well, when I got to the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins a few years ago, about 5 years ago, I just finished working in a series of jobs in the public sector, in addition to what you mentioned. I was the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore for several years. And at the Food and Drug Administration, I had been the acting commissioner during H1N1 at the beginning, and then was the principal deputy commissioner. And then I'd been the state health secretary. And I got to the school and I thought, you know, I need to teach a class. What should I teach? I want to teach the class that I really wish I had taken. And I wound up teaching a class called Crisis and Response in Public Health. And that class kind of brought together a whole bunch of different experiences I had, not only in those jobs, but also when I worked on Capitol Hill during and after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. It really emphasized my view that public health is more than just about strategic planning and long-term considerations. It's got to be responsive to crises, and it is hard to be responsive to crises. Politics interferes. It's very difficult to get messages out. It's hard to be organized. You get sort of confused and foggy when so many things are happening all at once. So I actually put together a class and later wrote a book called The Public Health Crisis Survival Guide, Leadership and Management in Trying Times. So to me, this feels like it's ripped from the pages of the book. I actually just finished teaching the class this week. And, you know, we started talking about the novel coronavirus sort of on the side. By the end, the class couldn't meet in person because of restrictions the university put on. We had to do it by video conference. And the students were like, we all talked about at what point did the actual crisis take over our thinking more than the crisis class. But for me, it's really been that class and that book, which was really a culmination of a whole bunch of different experiences.
Okay, before I forget to bring this up, you actually have a daily podcast on the specific subject of the novel coronavirus. Tell us about the podcast and what you're trying to do with it, and most importantly, where people can find it.
Thanks very much, Ben. So the podcast is called Public Health on Call. It's produced by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and we put it together when we realized, obviously, what a huge challenge the coronavirus is, and also when we realized that there's so many people at our school, which is the largest school of public health in the world, who have direct understanding and experience with viruses like the coronavirus and are actively working on it. So each episode, we interview one person for 10 to 15 minutes and get their perspective. The first one was with Dr. Justin Lessler. His day job is to model infectious disease dynamics. He looks at how infectious diseases spread. He is completely engaged in modeling the coronavirus. And the second one was with a virologist who named Andy Pekosh, and he talked about the work he's done on coronaviruses in the lab and what his key questions are. So we've talked about equity issues. We're going to have episodes on ethics. We've talked to the people at Johns Hopkins Medicine who are responsible for infection control. And we also every Friday do just a listener Q&A where we take people from the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins who've been really the leads in many aspects of the response for the university. And we just throw every question that we can find from listeners. We've gotten hundreds of questions in. We pick the ones that are common and we just ask them. So those have been the most popular podcasts, the Q&A.
All right. So the subject I want to talk to you about principally is the role of coercion in public health response to crises like this, because we are now dealing with a situation in which China's initial response was a disaster, and they are now getting credit by the WHO for bringing the situation under control using what are frankly a bunch of highly coercive measures that they are trumpeting. So I'm interested in the question of to what extent that is a legitimate or valuable model, or aspects of it are. But before we turn to that, let's get a sense of what the baseline is on the scale from complacency to five alarm fire. How do you assess where we are right now?
Well, I think for our country, this is a five alarm fire, meaning that, you know, the alarm bells are ringing. We haven't gotten to the point where the fires are raging, but we have to prepare like it could be a five alarm fire. So that's how I would put it. So we should be very, very seriously preparing, taking steps right now to make sure that we don't get to that point. And I would say that I think we're preparing like it's a two or three alarm fire that could be the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, what's happened in Italy has been the major wake up call. I think the initial problems that happened in Wuhan, people kind of chalked up a little bit to the fact that they kind of covered it up. They didn't know what it was, that it spread quite a lot before people really got their shoes on to take action against it, but that other places that were more prepared wouldn't see that level of a problem. And then when you see and hear from Italy that they're making decisions on who's living and dying in the hallways of hospitals, everyone realizes that this is not a drill, that this could come to the United States. And that's what a five-alarm fire looks like for this condition. It looks like our hospitals are swamped, our healthcare workers are sick, and people can't get the care they need, not only for the coronavirus, but for whatever else is ailing them.
And when you see numbers like the numbers that we have seen over the last week, which, you know, look like new confirmed cases are growing some days at a apparently exponential rate, some days at a higher linear rate, but they're growing fast. Does that say to you, in an atmosphere in which the testing has been impaired, that we are seeing a fraction of what is really happening? Or does that say to you that we have some significant localized outbreaks that need to be brought under control and some more general community spread? Like, how do you assess the U.S. numbers right now?
Well, I think one thing that's become more clear as more evidence is coming to light is that there's like a delay kind of baked into the spread of this virus. And the delay comes in part because it takes a certain number of days to get infected. It's much of a longer lag from one person to the next than for flu, for example. For flu, you most certainly get sick within a couple days of exposure, or that's common at least. Whereas for the novel coronavirus, it's, you know, usually 6 days, something like that. And so that makes it a little bit slower. And then there's a delay between people start getting sick and when they get really sick. And, you know, the evidence is weeks before people get really sick. And then they're sick for a while. So the burden is kind of hidden initially. And so the concern is that what we're seeing now isn't just now. It's the leading edge of a wave that's coming. And how big the wave is, we don't completely know. And that's the reason why, particularly now in the setting of such uncertainty, people are taking measures that, you know, are kind of astonishing even from where we were 2 weeks ago.
All right. So you said we've got the makings of a five-alarm fire and we're preparing for it like a two or three-alarm fire. So what is the low-hanging fruit that we're not doing that we should be doing? Before we get to the truly coercive side of it, what's the easy stuff that if you were in charge of federal or state response in a state, you would say, snap your fingers and do these things, and, you know, if you're serious, you would do?
So very, very high priority is very strong and consistent public messaging about basic hygiene. People generally don't wash their hands or cover their coughs or stay at home when they're sick. Those are real things. And when people do more of them, you see not only fewer cases of coronavirus, but the evidence that's emerged is that you see less diarrheal disease, less conjunctivitis. It really works. And everyone has to take it seriously. Now, that means not just telling people what to do, but it means really having everyone recognize the urgency and all the different messengers sending that message, not the it's just like another flu message. That does not help. Or young people won't get sick, so you don't have to worry about it message, which isn't exactly true and also can undermine the core hygiene messages. So that's number one. People should be taking it seriously and repeating those core messages. Number two, we know that people at highest risk for serious illness and death, the people who are going to be in the intensive care unit are older and sicker people at baseline. And, you know, particularly worrying about them, very strong messages for them, reaching them however you can, and then extra precautions should be in place in every nursing home and assisted living in the country. The fact that there are, I think, cases in now 10 nursing homes in the Seattle area is just a horrible situation for them. And that's where they're seeing enormous, you know, it's where they're seeing the bulk of the deaths. So a huge amount of attention there is extremely important. I think those are two immediate things. I also think that the more general social distancing that's being put into place as, you know, the epidemic spreads, encouraging people to telework, limiting large gatherings. In some cases, we can talk about schools a little bit as a little bit of an asterisk. Some people have different views on that. But whatever you can do, to reduce large gatherings spread is a reasonable thing to be doing at this point, particularly while we're in this period of some uncertainty. The uncertainty, as we know, is in part because we haven't been testing. It's also because we're just, you know, there's a lot of variability in what might happen in an epidemic.
All right. So I want to go through three positions that you've held and just ask, what would you be doing if you were in that position today? So let's start with the city health commissioner of Baltimore. And I don't mean this to criticize the incumbents of any of these positions.
Right.
But if you were running a city health authority today, what is the most important thing that that person could do?
So in addition to the things that I mentioned, I would focus on trying to make the healthcare system navigable for people. And what I mean by that is, if somebody has a question, what do they do? City Health Department can help them figure that out. If they're sick and they think they might need a test, what do they do? They shouldn't be showing up in the emergency department because that can, you know, cause all kinds of problems in terms of overstressing the emergency department or exposing people unnecessarily to coronavirus. You know, the hospitals, what do they need? Ultimately, I'm thinking in my city that the critical resource to protect is the hospital capacity. And so I want to find out what they need. If they need, you know, daycare for the, you know, send babysitters to the doctors and nurses' houses, I'll do that. A lot of the big decisions are being made at the federal and state level, but it's at the city level where the rubber really meets the road. And it's important to be flexible to the challenges that you're having. So I would want to be in touch with the core people, you know, the core group of people that is responsible for the healthcare system, and start problem solving anything that comes up in order to help protect their capacity. So the things I mentioned earlier, the messaging, the nursing homes, that's going to definitely have that impact. But really trying to make sure locally all the doctors know what to do, all the nurse lines know what to do, the urgent cares, everybody's singing from the same song sheet in order to have the healthcare system work as well as possible.
All right. So now, state health commissioner, there are four states that are disproportionately affected so far: New York, Washington, California, and Massachusetts. I think now 46, 47 states have had confirmed cases. So what is the statewide policy beyond messaging that, you know, states that have major outbreaks should be undertaking, but also states that are looking at a few cases can plausibly tell themselves that they're isolates if they want to be in denial, but also maybe shouldn't want to be in denial and should want to take precautions to avoid mass community spread?
Right. I think that the state has an absolutely critical role. States are really the public health leads in our overall legal system. They have the authority under the police powers to do all kinds of things that are necessary. And they have an enormous burden to step up at this moment. And, you know, I think that it's really the state's responsibility to set a signal on social distancing right now, to take important actions and to work with the localities to see those implemented through. And so I think that the kinds of steps like canceling conferences, you know, talking to employers, doing things with state workers as a model, encouraging them to telework, those are the sorts of things that I think states should be doing in a very clear way, explaining that why everybody, you know, needs to take this seriously and follow those. That's a really important thing. And good leadership here can make the difference between people really paying attention and people not paying attention.
All right. Finally, the Food and Drug Administration. How much of the testing problem is an FDA issue as opposed to a CDC issue? And what is it that the FDA can do right now? I mean, we're not talking about new drugs being available yet. We're not talking about vaccines being available. Does the FDA have any substantial proactive role to play here?
Yes, I think it does. And I mean, maybe it makes sense just to pause and talk for a second about testing. which obviously has been high of mind for a lot of people, that there's been a huge problem in getting access to testing in this country. And that problem has two components. One component is that the first test that the CDC developed didn't work, and that set the nation back by a few weeks.
Yeah, that's a heck of a problem.
That's a heck of a problem. It's a heck of a problem. And I think, you know, people who are watching the congressional testimony heard Dr. Anthony Fauci from NIH describe it as a failing, which it is. But that's not the only problem, because even if that test had worked, we still would have not had enough tests. And that's because the testing strategy was too limited. The testing strategy that the government set was really premised on the idea of containment, that we wouldn't have that many cases. We could look through travel to find people, and it'd be sort of like Ebola, you know, where you had to have a really clear exposure to get a test. And that really wasn't right. Now, if you say, like, well, why did they set that strategy? You have to really go back in time to, you know, what now seems like an era ago in mid-January, when we were getting pronouncements that, like, this was not going to be a problem for the United States. And, you know, maybe we'd had a few cases, but it would quickly go down to zero and we were airtight or near airtight. And you just have to imagine what it would have taken at that point for the CDC and FDA to say, you know, we were thinking of doing a strategy with just the CDC test in state labs, but even if that strategy is successful, we're not going to have nearly enough diagnostic tests for the clinical demand. So we're going to invite in the private manufacturers in an unprecedented way to be able to stand up a million tests in a month. So you would have had, you know, the White House saying, we think this isn't a big deal, go about your business, and kind of like a massive, you know, project, Manhattan project to get tests up really quickly. And that would have been incredibly difficult for those agencies to have done. And I think that may have played a factor in why they didn't. And interestingly, the person who was out there saying that that needed to happen more than anyone else that I saw was the former FDA commissioner under President Trump, Scott Gottlieb. He was tweeting, he was writing op-eds, he was saying, we can't do this the way that they're doing it. And even with that, they stuck with a much, much more limited strategy, which was more consonant with the political messaging.
And to be clear, do you think that, I mean, there's a question that has floated around politically of how much should, you know, President Trump be blamed for the testing fiasco, and how much is it just something that happened at the CDC level for which presidents are accountable, but there, you know, there's no direct relationship. You're positing here that there's at least a kind of indirect relationship.
Well, I'm saying that you have to realize there are two different problems. I don't think it's fair to blame the administration writ large for the testing failure. I mean, well, let's see what the investigation shows on that. For the failure of the CDC test, we're going to have to, that may have been just a scientific misstep.
No, but for the CDC's reticence about having a strategy that was more capacious, you're describing a responsiveness to a political environment being a feature of that.
I think that is fair. And I think, you know, it's intuitively fair. If you think back, if you could imagine that kind of effort being put into scale up massive testing at a time that the White House was saying, we don't think we're going to get that many cases at all. I just think that's just very hard to imagine. And that the political environment really matters. If you go back to, in my class, I teach about the 1976 swine flu, Ben, when you and I were, I guess, seven. And at that time, President Gerald Ford announced that every man, woman, and child would get vaccinated against this disease, which had killed one person, but nobody knew whether it was coming back. And there were a lot of people who thought that was the wrong strategy, but they just went ahead and did it because the president had said it. And, you know, lo and behold, they vaccinated tens of millions of people. The disease never came back. A bunch of people had some adverse events. The whole program had to stop. It was hugely embarrassing for CDC. And in the postmortems of that, it was, don't have the president set policy on this, because the president of any party, it's a chilling effect on the ability to be flexible to the circumstances of an epidemic.
All right, that brings us very naturally to the subject of coercion. A guy who had an extant test gets on an airplane yesterday and flies to Florida from New York. While he's on the plane, the test comes back positive. As a general matter, how coercive should we be being about forcing people to behave in ways that will at least not exacerbate the problem if they're not willing to do things that will minimize the problem?
So there are some principles around coercion, and you know, some of them include that we have to distinguish between coercion for isolation and coercion for quarantine. So isolation is with people who are sick and actually very infectious at the moment. So that can be pretty important to make sure that people are not in contact with other people. Now, a second principle, which maybe I should have put first, is that voluntary steps are always better than using the control powers of the state to enforce them. If you can get someone to do it voluntarily, that is just way easier. So if somebody is sick, you tell them to isolate themselves at home. They're happy to do it. That's great. If somebody is tweeting on social media, I have COVID-19 and I'm running down the street touching everybody, that's a problem, you know? And so when I was a health commissioner in Baltimore, I signed mandatory isolation orders for people with tuberculosis who refused to get treatment or isolate themselves. And some of those people were put in a special place, I think, in jail for a period of time until they were no longer infectious. And I mean, that's a serious power to have. And I did that rarely, but you can understand why a community needs that power in an extreme situation. And so isolation of somebody who's sick in a specific circumstance, if it's the least, you know, restrictive thing, if you basically have to do it, people can understand that. Now you switch to quarantine, where people have been exposed, but they're not ill. That's quarantine. And in that situation, you know, again, voluntary is so much better. And many places around the world have done fine with, you know, with more voluntary approaches, not putting police out on the street or threatening people directly. And this is where good communications is important, because you want people to follow things voluntarily and not push you down the avenue of doing more. The other principle is that it should be focused on as narrowly as possible. And so like kind of quarantining entire areas is very controversial, and people are worried that it could lead to more harm than good. I was speaking with on our podcast, recording an episode with Professor Len Rubenstein of the School of Public Health. We were talking about examples in Ebola where people tried to, you know, literally put a fence around towns in Africa, and it, you know, led to massive spread of Ebola and didn't really help the overall public health response. So it's very risky to try to do massive quarantines of people who are not sick. It can lead to those areas not getting the medical care that they need, and it can actually lead to more spread. And if the quarantine is leaky, overall subvert the public health effort. So right now, the focus is to try to get people to self-quarantine if they've been exposed, to the extent that that's appropriate, and, you know, do as many things at this moment voluntarily and try to use force as little as possible.
When you look at the Chinese response, which, as best as I can tell, was a kind of disaster of authoritarianism in the early days of it, which is to say, people not accurately reporting what had happened out of what was happening in Hubei out of fear of disapproval from higher ups, information being covered up, and therefore a lot of spread taking place and a lot of lost time. Then the party snaps in and imposes these draconian restrictions down to the like apartment building level all over the country. And you have what is being touted by the WHO as a successful remediation or mitigation strategy that seems to be as much a feature of authoritarianism as the initial disaster was. And so my question is, when you look at the Chinese response, what part of it seems to you, I wouldn't say attractive, because there's nothing attractive about the kind of coercion that they're using, but what are the aspects of it that are have been effective, and what are the aspects that are needless exertions of power over civilians who didn't do anything wrong?
So I think that one of the points you're making is very important, which is honesty and transparency about an epidemic is extremely important for its control. And what happened initially there, I think without a doubt, caused it to spread and maybe one reason why we have this, you know, huge global challenge now. When Wuhan got into such a serious problem and, you know, the crackdown was so draconian, it's clear, I think, that that crackdown made it harder for people to get care and maybe responsible for the very high fatality rates there. Not to mention other kind of civil liberties restrictions that were put into place. I think if you're looking at China, the cities outside are probably more instructive than the cities that were in that initial zone. You know, the cities like Shanghai and Beijing have not had that many cases, as many certainly as you might expect. And they did that without having to do, I think, quite the same level of control that was employed in the Wuhan area. And it was with a lot of testing. It was with a lot of social distancing. And I think the lesson that people have taken from that is that this is, you know, a virus that's behaving like other viruses in the past where social distancing can work. And so the lesson is that if we can reduce interactions, we can reduce the spread. And ideally, we're starting to do those before it gets nearly as bad there so that it never gets that bad here. So I can say that again. It ideally, we're putting these measures into place before it gets so bad here so it doesn't get that bad here. And I think the lesson people are drawing is that in the absence of a vaccine, in the absence of treatments, this is a potentially effective set of tools, and you don't necessarily need the heavy hand of the state to see them accomplished. And you can look at South Korea or Taiwan, for example, Hong Kong and Singapore, to see that you don't need to use the whole authoritarian toolkit in order to have some success against this virus.
What about the quasi-authoritarian toolkit, or maybe it's not quasi? One of the things that's striking about Beijing, and I suspect other cities and, you know, in China now, is that you walk into your apartment building, they're going to take your temperature. You walk out, they take your temperature. You go to work, they take your temperature. These are crude screenings because there are, of course, a lot of reasons why people's temperature can be elevated. But should people be taking their temperatures all the time, you know, or should a condition of being in public be that your temperature is known to be in the normal range?
I think some of those are prudent steps. Like if you're, you know, running a nursing home, check the temperature of the staff before people come in, you know, make sure that you're protecting the people who are there, even though it is kind of crude. You should also ask them whether they're coughing. You know, I think those kinds of things at different points are good things to be doing now. And I think, you know, that's not a major infringement on liberty. And if it identifies people who didn't realize they had a fever and then they can zip home and isolate themselves, that's a good thing to accomplish. So I think like we need to be in that space right now. I mean, you know, not everyone's walking around with a thermometer in their mouth, but, you know, in a space where people are really vigilant in order to take the easy opportunities to reduce the spread of the virus.
I want to chat briefly about what went wrong in Italy. The Italian healthcare system is a good one. It has a lot of features that people find. It delivers fairly high quality service to 60 million people on a daily basis. And it seems to have completely collapsed under, at least in the north, under this virus. What did Italy do wrong that those countries a few weeks behind it can look at and say, those are negative examples?
So I don't know all the details about Italy, but I think a mistake that people may have made, based in part on what's now emerging about the delay in the virus, is to think when you're looking at the virus now, you're really seeing the problem. You're kind of looking at a planet through a telescope where you're seeing it almost in the past. you know, it's taken a while for the light to come. And it may be that that planet's changed in that time period, but you don't really see that. You think you're seeing, you know, it looks like you're seeing it now, but really you're seeing it before when it emitted the light.
But just to be clear, how many light days ago, when we look at the numbers in the U.S. today, are we looking 2 weeks ago? Are we looking 6 days ago? How long should we understand the latency to be?
Well, the numbers in the United States aren't good because we don't have testing. So it's very, that's the big asterisk for the United States. And that may have been part of the issue in Italy, that they didn't have a good picture. They couldn't even see that well through the telescope. But to the extent they were getting anything, it was basically probably a month behind, in the sense that people are going to be spreading it and the people are going to be getting sick. And so if you're not taking actions, aggressive actions very early, and you're waiting for a lot of sick people, by the time there are a good number of sick people, there is a huge burden of disease out there and a wave of sick people coming, and it may be too late. And I think that may have been part of the challenge. And, you know, if you think about flu, for example, where it moves much faster, you can use the number of cases to respond, I think, quicker. With the delay in coronavirus, I think people may have underappreciated how hard it is once you are behind to get ahead of a problem like this. And I think it really is Italy that is making people very aggressive now, even compared to just a few days ago, frankly.
And is any country, I mean, you mentioned Taiwan and Singapore and South Korea, is there any European country that's kind of exposed to the Schengen, EU, free flow of people mobility issue that is really doing a good job with this right now?
You know, I think it's probably too early to say because we don't know exactly the spread of people. I mean, the number of cases in different places and when the infection was introduced. You know, in general, once an infection gets established, it's less about the people coming in than it is about the control measures that are put in place. So it won't be so much about border policy, and that's true for the United States. It's going to be about health and social policy locally. I think the other European countries are getting the Italian memo, from what I can tell, and this is really just, you know, playing out now. And so we're going to see whether some of those other countries are able to put in place enough restrictions to dramatically reduce the virus and, you know, do the so-called flatten the curve so you don't get a big spike of patients like they saw in Italy to overwhelm the healthcare system.
We've been pretty disciplined about not talking about the president, which is always my preference. But I do think, given your focus on the importance of public messaging, the dissonance between the public messaging that you would like to see and the public messaging that the White House is engaged in on a daily basis is worth discussing. If you could take over the mind of the president and, you know, control him like a marionette for the limited purpose of coronavirus response, what would he do and what would he say that would, other than wash your hands, like what are the things that the president could do right now that for whatever reason he is not willing to do or unable to do?
Well, I think that there are issues of both form and substance. And the form is important too, which is I don't think the president should be the lead messenger to the American people on this. I think the president should be a supportive messenger, should have, you know, very inspirational, candid things to say, but that really be deferring to a messenger or a couple messengers who the public can get to know and trust and have credibility. And the reason for that is, first of all, the situation is changing, and it's really people with credibility who can explain the changes. They can explain why we told you to do A yesterday and B today without people thinking it's like a flip-flop. And the president should really be at arm's length from those kinds of decisions. Not saying I'm making this decision, I'm making that decision. It should be the president supporting the decision made by the health leadership to do X or Y for these reasons, and we will be constantly reevaluating that. So there's a fundamental form problem, I think, here, where when the president is there, it sometimes seems like, you know, he's there just deciding what to do. You know, let's close the border to Europe. Let's do this. Let's do that. And it's not giving people confidence that people who really know what they're doing in this situation are in a position to guide the response. So I think that that is a major issue. And I just think in general, this is for any president, you know, of any political party. It's harder for a politician to be being the primary messenger at a time like this, in part because it's just very hard for them to change their mind. It looks like flip-flopping when a politician does it. It looks like a smart thing to do when Dr. Fauci explains that we need to do something different. So it, that's fundamental. And then in terms of the actual messaging itself, I think that for whatever it's worth, the president has to set the tone for the country. And the tone right now has to be, this is not a drill. This is a very serious situation. Everyone has to pay attention. And here's what I'm doing. Here's what my family is doing. Here's what Congress is doing. You know, we're in this together. And what we do now really matters. And I think, you know, it's got to be inspirational to others and not just talking about what the president, you know, may have done or not done specifically, you know, out there to try to protect everyone. It's really got to help people realize what they need to do. And, you know, there are a lot of lives that potentially are in the balance in terms of whether people hear messages and take advantage of them.
I mean, obviously, what you're describing there with the president is be a different person. But so now let's take it down a notch. If you were still running the FDA or if you were running the CDC, what are the switches you could flip that would make a difference today?
Well, I think for the FDA, the agency has to be thinking right now about therapeutics and vaccines, not just diagnostic tests. So I know already there are some studies of drugs that may have antiviral activity against the novel coronavirus. That's important. There are also other studies about what's the best way to do supportive care. Those are really important. So facilitating those studies, bringing the best expertise. There's so many great people at the FDA to advise those studies, you know, make them as effective as possible. That's really important. There are also some other interesting therapeutic ideas. Dr. Arturo Casadevall at the School of Public Health, who's the chair of our Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology, has been writing and talking and planning about the idea of using convalescent serum, the antibodies, essentially from people who have recovered. And there are a lot of people who have recovered from coronavirus. Giving small amounts to people as prevention and maybe larger amounts as treatment. This is what actually was good medicine proven to work in the beginning part of the 20th century before the antibiotic era. So he's dusted off some of those papers and he wants to stand up a clinical trial quickly. And I think the FDA should help. So there are things that could be more readily available in terms of treatment in the short term. And that has got to be just a huge priority for the agency. And then vaccines, it sounds like the FDA is working with the NIH in standing up vaccine trials very quickly, maybe quicker than has ever been done before. And, you know, the role of the agency there is extremely important to make sure that the manufacturing is good and all the things that need to happen. We were able to stand up a H1N1 vaccine in record time in H1N1, working with the industry and the team at FDA has got to be really at the top of their game for that to happen. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. And, you know, the big lesson here is that the major uncertainty that we're dealing with right now is not a permanent state. We are going to know a lot more about the virus. We're going to know a lot more about treatment. We're going to hear about vaccines. The reason that, you know, a lot of serious steps are being taken now is because we're in this very dangerous period of uncertainty when we just don't know how big the wave is that may be coming.
Finally, I want to ask you briefly about international cooperation. The president, in his speech the other night, treated this as a foreign-based problem that risked invading, or we were going to prevent from invading the United States. How should the United States be interacting with other governments on this matter, including other governments with major, you know, infection problem themselves, like, for example, Italy or France and Germany?
Yes, I think This is a global challenge. This is humankind versus virus. And this isn't one country versus another. And the global cooperation is critical for so many of these issues, to stand up clinical trials, to work with regulators in other countries, to identify strategies that work and strategies that don't work. I mean, this should be a period of the world coming together, not coming apart. We should be helping other places. We should be getting help where we can from other places. And, you know, I think there was a reason why there was an office in the National Security Council for this kind of collaboration on pandemics. And I think it is going to be part of the story that's written, that the shuttering of that office has set us back, not just in the early stages, but in the ability to really do good coordination with other countries. And it could prove very important. We'll have to see how this plays out. But I don't like the rhetoric of us versus them. I think that this is humankind versus virus.
Remind us of the name of your book.
The book is The Public Health Crisis Survival Guide, Leadership and Management in Trying Times.
Remind us of the name of the podcast.
Thank you. The podcast is Public Health On Call, and it's available in all the various places to get podcasts.
Josh Sharfstein, thanks so much for joining us. You are the first in 520 some odd episodes of the Lawfare podcast. You are the first member of our high school class to join me on the Lawfare podcast. So that, add that to your long list of distinctions.
Well, I can just say, if anybody wants stories of you in chemistry class, they can just look up my email address and email me, and I'd be happy to provide them.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey guys, a special thanks as we have gone virtual to the people who have made our virtual Lawfare podcast in exile possible, particularly to Lawfare's redoubtable associate editors and podcast engineers, Michaela Fogel, who handled this episode, and Jacob Schultz. If we sound good, it is because of them. And if we don't sound good, we really don't want to hear about it because we're doing the best we can. You should promote the Lawfare podcast, as you always should. You should share it on social media. You should give it a review wherever you found it. And you know what kind of review you should give it. You should buy merch from thelawfarestore.com. You should thank Sophia Yan, who, by the way, there is on the Lawfare Facebook page video of Sophia Yan now playing the piano in isolation in Beijing. You should thank her for performing our music. And as always, the Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by the one, the only, Jen Patya Howell. And thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.